The following is a presentation of the Black Hollywood Live Network, the first online broadcast network dedicated to African-American entertainment. Hollywood Redefined. From Los Angeles, California, presented by Maria Menounos and streaming live thanks to Akamai Technologies, this is Black Hollywood Live. Success is the new black. Featuring in-depth interviews with today's top businessmen and women. Black Hollywood Live. Hollywood Redefined.
You're listening to Black Hollywood Live.
And now, the host of Black Hollywood Live, Success is the New Black.
Where's my music? There we go. Yeah, I like to have my music going. Take you back to what, 95?
Yeah.
Yeah, so for real. Anyway. We're in the building. This is another episode of Success is the New Black. I am Ron Moore, and I am definitely being joined by the beautiful, the lovely Miss English Cleveland. How you doing?
I'm doing good tonight.
That is wonderful, as always. Today is going to be a good show.
It is going to be a good show.
Yeah, how you been? You been good?
I'm good. How are you this week?
Pretty good. Working, you know.
Same we old, here. Same old.
Yeah.
We are here, and we are joined with the...
Yeah, the...
Standout comedian.
Yeah, I'm gonna just go through some of this.
Yeah, you go down the list.
Just the man behind the prank call CDs. Mm-hmm. Let me make sure I get it right. My mama made me wear this Confessions of a Bench Warmer, and I slap you to sleep. He's been on Last Comic Standing. You've seen him everywhere from Comic View to the David Letterman show. Mm-hmm. And you've also seen him on the Ramsey High School baseball team.
Yeah, riding that damn bench.
Yeah, you know it. You can currently catch him on TBS's Sullivan and Son, ironically playing a man named Roy, my boy Birmingham, Alabama. Roy Wood Jr.
How the hell are you, Rome? Man. English. Thank y'all for having me, man. This is an honor and a pleasure. I appreciate you for the invite and having me on. Can I keep the mug?
Yes,
you can. That's your souvenir.
One of these official Black Hollywood. No. The white dude just came.
You can't keep the mug, man.
Yeah, white people be listening at all times.
Quick, man.
You're like, nope, listen, bro.
The white people.
Buy your own damn mug. I'll break this mug. I got basic cable money.
You can keep the pieces of the mug.
Really?
But yeah, man. Thanks for having me, man. This is cool, man.
Yeah, dude. I appreciate you coming through. Definitely. A lot of guys don't know this is the first guest that we've had on that I know from high school.
Like
literally.
From high school. Like
ROTC.
When I had that 2.3 GPA, baby.
Man, you were working it.
Working at the radio. So here's the thing. This is my defense of having a 2.3. Number one, my standardized test was off the chain. I worked a lot in high school.
Okay.
I had stuff to do. Everybody want to guilt trip C students. Like, ooh, you make a C. I had stuff to do. Like, how much do I need to know to not take this class again? That's all I'm interested in.
Right.
And that's it. I don't need to learn
just
nothing else.
Just get far enough. You're good.
Reading is overrated, Ron. That's what people don't tell you.
They don't ever let you in on that part.
You make enough money, you pay people to read stuff on your behalf, and that's what I'm trying to get to.
I feel you, bro.
That is the worst advice ever. This show's called Success. Giving horrible advice.
Other people can do it for you. Just get them straighten it out. Yeah.
But yeah, those were good times, man. You know, that's why I started comedy. I started when I was I started when I was at Florida A&M, I was coming back and forth to Birmingham for open mics. And then when I graduated from college, I came back home in 01 and started at the radio station over at 95.7. And that was when Ricky Smiley left. And, you know, Ricky Smiley is, you know, that's one of the black comedy gods up there, man. You know, he had a syndicated show now. I think he's doing 4 million listeners every morning. That's Tom Joyner status. But at the time, he was just the local dude telling chuckles on the radio. Mm-hmm. And so when he blew up off of Comic View and everything, I kind of slid in behind him. Mm-hmm. And he kind of gave me the game on some of the pranks. Him and Buck Wild, who was the morning show host at the time. And, you know, honestly, like radio, my time in radio, it was enough to help keep me grounded while I still worked the road. Because I think a lot of comics early on, man, you're not getting a lot of opportunities and you're not getting a lot of chances to work the road. Like, there was stretches where I had a gig every other month. Like, one gig.
Just, and it
was
one, that's it.
12-minute set.
Yeah.
Somewhere in Kentucky. And then for the next month and a half, you're trying to figure out what's the next thing. And radio was able to, give me something to still work those creative juices so I didn't just sit in the dog. I'd have ended up on cocaine. That's what I'm trying to say. Is that without radio, I would have ended up bored with nothing to do every day. Just and chilling. That's 8 babies and a cocaine habit.
All right, Rick James. that's where we were headed with that one. Man, but yo, he brought up FAMU. So right. I got to go back. I don't know if you may be privy to this story, but I know I've definitely heard it. And you got to tell it to our listeners.
Which one you going to bring up from FAMU? Are you talking about the alleged FAMU sex tape? Are you going to bring up the Hazen drum major? Which one?
Uh-oh. No, because that all happened after you were there. I mean,
are you talking about me?
Tape, I'm talking about you personally.
Oh, I ain't made no sex tape.
Now, we're getting to the FAMU sex tape. I made a sex tape once,
but it's on VHS, so y'all ain't going to ever see it.
That's
gone. And it's grainy, the tracking, the little static.
Tracking all off. You got to turn that little knob on the thing.
But nah, man, I was a cut-up when I was in college, man. Yeah. And people who know me know that, and I've talked about it on the record before. I got arrested when I was in college. I had a work study and her eyes bugged out. No, I wasn't like running kilos of cocaine. No.
Nino Brown in the studio.
That's what happened. You're like, yeah, well, you know, I got arrested before.
Yeah.
How many people did you murder? No, I had a work study in the post office, so my hustle was to just try and get a credit card out the mail. I was a mail sorter at the post office.
Right.
So you ain't got the credit card, you ain't gonna miss it. So I figured, then let me borrow your credit card right quick and take that thing to Macy's and ching-ching.
Yeah.
What happened?
I got caught. That's what happened. I got caught. And what happened after that was, you know, it was a big depression for me.
Yeah.
Because I was 19 years old. And at the time, when you're suspended from school and you got a lawyer telling you you might go to jail, I'm like, well, damn, this is a wrap
for
me.
It's real.
Life. Like, life hits you dead in the face. And so I took a long look at myself, and, you know, people call it luck, some people call it God, but whatever it was, somebody was looking out for me, because I got suspended from school at the beginning of the year, like in January, for my junior year. And 2 weeks later, I got my check for my financial aid. So I had a check for $8,000, but I had no classes to pay for. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I just started doing stand-up. That's why I got into stand-up, was because I got arrested, and it helped me deal with the depression. It was literally the only thing I had to look forward to every day. Mm-hmm. So I would do the stand-up, and I'm suspended from school, and you telling me that I got $8,000 so I can just drive around?
Right.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, man. You can go.
So basically, I got fronted all the money I needed to get my comedy career off the ground. And so by the time I got back in school, I had enough pieces in place with other clubs around the area that I was pretty much able to do comedy and still stay in school and make money off of both. So by the time I graduated, I was 3 years deep into comedy. Mm-hmm. So as a comic, starting out early on, that's a huge advantage.
Right.
And you're only 21, 22 years old, and you already have 3 years underneath you, and you've already slaved through the you ain't going to make no money, it's horrible. And you're still not making any money, but you're making enough money to sustain yourself. I came up in college, man, I had 3 roommates. Mm-hmm. All I had to do was cover $250 a month.
Wow.
That was it.
Yeah.
I covered that at Golden Corral in 2 shifts on the weekend.
Yeah,
so
easy.
Comedy money was extra gravy. So by the time I got out of school, it was full steam ahead with the stand-up and radio, and those two things just kind of ran simultaneously for me. And that's, for me, that's where my life changed. That's where, like, literally I made a U-turn and went a totally different direction. Yeah, and I got the degree in broadcast, and that became, oh, my God. Like, even to this day with some of the radio I still do, that damn degree still is good to have in my back pocket, because I'm one of the few comics that's doing radio that has a degree in it.
Yeah.
Right.
So it seems all you do is be funny. It'd be funny. When it come down to them corporate meetings and all that stupid white collar Fortune 500 nonsense, and they all around the table deciding what to do and whether or not you know what you're talking about, the degree, for whatever reason, is what adds validity to anything you say. And you're not seen as just another ignorant chuckle dude just making a couple of jokes on the air for some money.
Yeah. Opens the door.
Mm-hmm. That's the short version of the story.
I'm like, did you create jokes out of your experience?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I saw a dude. I was in jail. I got arrested the night before Thanksgiving. And so they don't, like, process you on holidays.
So you was stuck.
Yeah.
So no turkey, no nothing.
Oh, no. The turkey was delicious. Let me tell you something right now.
No. They have mac and cheese, too?
Leon County Jail in Tallahassee. If you ever get a chance to get arrested,
okay.
Leon County is where you want to get okay. arrested. That That's was what. I don't know if it was I was just hungry,
yeah.
or what, but that was some of the most delicious turkey. It tastes like freedom turkey.
No. Ooh.
Mm. Damn.
I mean, it's jail food. It's still horrible. Yeah. I don't want you to think they're serving Roscoe's.
Well, let me make a trip today. What do I need to do?
Like, what do I need to
yes,
know?
We're here to get arrested. We want to just try the fine dining.
Well, you got to break a law or something. Well, you know, give me a little bit of weed. Let me go stand on the corner.
I talk a little bit about it on stage here and there, but over the course of my career, it's been a part of my life that you know, I'll happily share in interviews, but to figure out the right way to really package that properly,
yeah.
I haven't been given an opportunity to do so on television. Most of the sets that I do on TV are 7 to 10 minutes. I haven't been given a half hour by a major network. I haven't been given an hour special by a network. Eventually, I have to shoot and produce that myself.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're doing Conan and Letterman for 4 or 5 minutes, there ain't enough time to explain. Yeah. Well, I stole the credit card. Wait, let me, don't judge me. Wait, I got a punchline. It's just not time for that. So I just share other stuff that makes me mad and annoys me, and that's effective.
Yeah.
What makes you mad and annoys you?
Little things.
Like
I'm not.
Like selfies?
I'm not. I hate selfies. I think any man that takes more than 3 selfies a month should reevaluate himself.
I say that if I go through a guy's Instagram and I see more than like 2 selfies, I'm like,
yeah, 2 thumb scrolls. No, yeah, 1 selfie per thumb swoosh.
And if it's per within the same week,
you got too many.
You're posting too much and you have too
got
many
got the game
selfies.
Messed up.
The internet as a whole is just a sad place. Social media is just one big ple- does anybody like me? Like, that's literally.
That's
yes.
Yeah.
It's a self-confidence.
Exactly. There was booster. A study on that that came out a couple of weeks ago where they said that there is a tie-in to people, their self-esteem and mm-hmm. to the level of response they get. And the psychologist studied people and the people who were more depressed were getting fewer likes.
Yeah, I believe
on their social media.
I totally believe it.
Like my picture. I need some help. Like me.
Yeah, I mean, little better. Stuff like that makes me mad. I don't like the fact that in Los Angeles you have to pay for shopping bags. When you go
at
the grocery store, and that's foreign to people back east. Mm-hmm. I try and explain it to them. They're like, what? Who do we murder? How do we stop this?
That messed me up. I went home for the holidays, and it went into effect on January the 1st.
Uh-huh.
So I came back, and I'm just going to the store. You know, I'm thinking, hey, it's a normal day. Let me go up to the little fresh and easy Ralph's, get what I need to get. And there it was. You know, the lady's like, that'll be 60 cents for your bags. I'm like, wait, what do you mean 60 cents for my bags? And it caught me completely off guard.
It's just something new for them to charge us for. That's all it is. Just what? They'll pay for this? It's like luggage fees at the airport.
Exactly.
There was no luggage fee 10 years ago, security. We need to pay the people who will unzip your luggage, so we need $40 from you because you packed too many draws.
Yeah.
So I need $40. I leave it at the airport.
Yeah, just right there.
Oh, I do. The lady be like, sir, your luggage is overweight by 3 ounces. You have to pay an overage fee. I just leave draws on the ground.
Here you go, TSA.
No, I don't even have them. I just leave them on the ground. It was, sir, you left your draws. They're like, nope, that's not my draws.
I don't care.
And what about the post office? Now you have to pay for tape.
The post office is a hustle. They figured that out.
Yeah.
They had that tape sitting up there.
And then you never remember to bring back the tape that you buy from there. That's $3.50.
Yeah.
So then you're just constantly.
You got 6 rolls of post office tape.
No, I have 10. I was just telling someone this today. I was like, I need to go home before I go to the post office to get my tape.
Because I have 10 of them by now, and it's
not like a collector's item.
A hustle. Man, Roy, When you were at FAM, you famously skipped a final, correct? To open for Tommy Davidson?
It was a midterm. It wasn't
it was a
midterm. Final.
Okay,
I skipped a midterm.
Mm-hmm.
I thought he was going to, you know, like I had delusions of grandeur back in those days.
Yeah.
I thought the way to be famous, and then not I'm going to make it. He going to see me, he going to like me, and he going to take me to the top with him. Tommy Davidson. And, you know, this is 2000, and, you know, Tommy Davidson is a legend, of course, but when you look at closer to where he was from the ending of In Living Color, and he was doing all the movies with Jim Carrey, and I'm like, oh, man, Tommy Davidson going to introduce, watch, I'm going to rip this show.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the call from the Booker on a Monday. My midterm was Wednesday, but I had to be in Charlotte Wednesday night for the first show. And so I just I just straight left. I flunked the class.
Yeah.
Just, but in my head, I was a full-time comedian. College was just something to do, and I understood it. But if I miss a couple courses, I'll figure it out. I'll get the degree. But in the meantime, you can't turn down Tommy Davidson. I get to Charlotte. I do all the shows, Wednesday through Saturday. And I'm an MC, so it's only so good you're going to do in 7 minutes. But in my head, it's standing ovation.
Encore.
Really?
Man, demolishing with these garbage-ass jokes I used to tell. Because I was like, I was a kid. I was like, man, you book buyback. You ever go to the bookstore to turn in your geometry? But I'm telling this joke to like 48-year-old black people. They've been to college since 71. And back then, they didn't even have geometry. Black people weren't allowed to take math till 84.
Right.
So Tommy Davidson, the last night, he comes backstage. He goes, where you from, brother? In my head, I'm like, oh, this is it. This is it.
Yeah. Get ready.
Take me with him to L.A. No lie, English. I packed extra clothes.
No, you didn't.
He was
real tough. Real tough. I packed extra clothes in case Tommy Davidson asked me to come back to L.A. with
him. But at least you thought about everything that you do. You were like, okay, I'm going to not go take this test. I'm going to go be a star, and I'm going to pack extra clothes.
If I flunk, I flunk. You can take the test again. Yeah. But you don't know when Tommy Davidson's coming back over that horizon.
That's true.
So I'm going. I go to Charlotte, and he says, where you from, brother? I go, I'm from Birmingham. Keep at it, brother. And walk out the room. Out. I was like, no! Bitch, you're supposed to take me with you.
Did you look like why yet?
It's my chance. He's leaving.
Didn't hear a single joke, but I heard you did good.
Wow.
Keep at it, brother. And walk clean out the room, man. And just had just walked out the room, just gorgeous women, like just the glow of show business floating out of the door. And I was just like, damn, I'll never be that famous. And it's funny because since then I've opened for him like 4 or 5 times over my career. And I finally told him that story, and he was like, I don't know where you thought I was going to take your ass. He said, I'm out here trying to get it.
Yeah.
I mean, there was, like, that was one of those, like, in terms of, like, I don't know if you guys have a story like this, or like that time where you legitimately saw fame. Mm-hmm. You witnessed someone just do some famous people-ish, where it's just like, wow. I was in the same hotel as Jodeci years ago. It was, 2001 or something. Mm-hmm. It was in Valdosta, Georgia. And me and the other comedian, we're in front of the hotel. It's like Holiday Inn or whatever. And this is Jodeci on the back end of their career.
Yeah,
like
they were already on the
crack hadn't completely got them yet. But they had just met their dealer. And it was the first shipment of crack.
Right.
Yeah.
Devontae was still there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. They still was doing shows and doing numbers. So me and Henry Coleman, we're sitting in front of this hotel, and we see Devontae come out. We see Casey come out. We see JoJo come out. Mm-hmm. And JoJo stands there, lights a cigarette. Other boys go in the limo. And then you see, like, 8 women walk past, and they all get in the limo. And I go, damn, there's 8 women, 2 dudes.
Yeah.
3 dudes, ain't but 3 people in Georgia City.
How they doing this?
What the other ones going to do?
Where are they
going?
Are they going to watch?
Yeah. And keep in mind, me and Henry Coleman are like arguing over which chick is the last to play pool at some horrible comedy show. She played the one in the jeans. That's mine, bro. The one in the blue jeans and the Alabama Crimson Tide t-shirt. She mine. I called her. But they got 8 stallions in the car. So then this business manager type dude walks by. And he walks up to the limo door, and the women are all in there. And this is the most famous thing I've ever heard in my life. He leans in the limo and looks at all 8 women. He goes, ladies, just so you know, if you in this limo tonight, we are doing adult things. So if you're not here to be an adult, you need to get your childish ass out right now.
No.
Damn.
Nobody moved.
Yeah.
And you said that's some player.
Every single woman stayed in that limo. And JoJo's standing there at the door, finishes his cigarette, and he looks at me and Henry Coleman. He just goes, good evening, fellas. And just walked off.
Did music play? Did, like, was smoke clear out of the...
Did that famous? Yeah. That famous driving off in the limo. Look at the limo driving off. Like, it was the smoothest thing. Like, yeah, you know I'm finna have sex with all these women, right? Good evening, fellas. Just, like, one day.
You know.
Like, literally, like, it's just, one day, maybe. But probably not. just walked off.
Wow. Yeah. So the key to having a crack habit is 8 women at one time. All right, I got it.
That's
cool.
The key to losing all your money.
Yeah, yeah.
If
yeah,
nothing
man.
Else.
Yeah, that happened too. Man.
Yeah, that was you know, those days, you know, I'll always love and remember, but, you know. Yeah. Little stuff like that is what always stuck out for me.
But since he told that story, mm-hmm. I got to flip it and see about the other side. See if this matches up. When you started working with the Blue Collar Comedy Tour.
Okay.
How
Foxworthy,
was
Ron White, Larry the Cable Guy, Bill Engvall.
Yeah, you were, how many years in were you when you started that? That was...
Blue Collar started around 07, so I probably had 8 years under me.
8 years in,
Eight or 9 years underneath me. I mean, the tour was already going on, probably 05, 06.
Yeah.
But by the time I got involved with them, it was like 07, because I know that was right when I first moved to L.A.
Yeah.
And I only did one of the bigger tours, but what I ended up doing was opening more for Bill Engvall and Ron White, just them individually on their like solo dates that yeah. they did on the road.
And I know this is Black Hollywood Live, but come on, black people. You definitely know who Ron White is.
Ron White is hands down... Top five funniest comics working today. Yeah. I mean, the brother just had me on Country Music Television, Salute to the Troops. We just did an hour special for the troops. This was a month ago. It's probably still streaming on CMT. And, you know, Ron has always been a supporter of what I do, and I've always been gracious to him for that because he didn't have to be.
Yeah.
He's more than successful enough. He didn't have to give a damn about any new comics, and that's why I've always been a supporter of him. And his comedy is universal, man. Mm-hmm. I saw him do a show... in Los Angeles, there's a show on Monday nights called Mo' Better Mondays. It's hosted by D. Ray Davis, who everybody mm-hmm. knows, Mind of a Man, Game Show Network.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the blackest crowds you will ever perform in front of in Los Angeles. And Ron White just walked on stage. And, like, on this night, like, DJ Drama is in the mm-hmm. crowd. And Spike Lee is over in the corner mm-hmm. somewhere. And Ron White just stood there and did his material verbatim the same way he would in front of a bunch of rednecks back east. And it destroyed. Black people loved him, man.
Yeah.
And it was...
Ron is the dude.
It was one of those... That stretch of working with those guys was where I really learned about how to refine just talking for my crowd. I was kind of transitioning into that mm-hmm. because my first 4 years of comedy, my first 4 years of TV credits were all black credits. It was all Apollo and BET. So when you're building jokes for television, you tend to skew a little bit black in your topic selection, a little bit black in your delivery style.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got into doing Comedy Central, and they did a Star Search reboot real quick with Arsenio when American Idol
right.
first started. And
right.
so once I started doing wider television shows, I was having a difficulty with the transition of my material because it was the same joke, but I was like, all right, I was too black. How do I... Not,
how do I fix it?
How do I tell this joke but in a white style? And by the time I started working with the Blue Collar guys and doing stuff with Bob and Tom Radio, who was integral as well in my development, those guys, like, performing in front of all white crowds that was not expecting to see a black person that week,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
it really got my style much more level.
Yeah, you can't help but to get... I definitely get refined in that type of situation.
Yeah, it's so you have to, man. It's sink or swim.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't a really hood act to begin with. I mean, I was never what they would stereotype as a Def Jam act or whatever, mm-hmm. but I had to change my delivery in some ways early on because I wasn't doing a lot of typical topics. So yeah. I had to figure out ways, like with black audiences, all right, if I talk louder and faster, it connected more
right.
because – black people enjoy volume. Just if you just look at comics that tend to connect, it's loud, it's fast.
Yeah.
And it's not a bad thing. It's just a matter of how most black audiences receive information.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Loud and fast don't work for white people. They feel like they're getting yelled at. Like, mm-hmm. Or some people legitimately can't keep up because of the slang, and I'm from Alabama, so you got to add in an account for my southern drawl. Mm-hmm. So you learn how to slow down, pace yourself, and then you discover, well, damn, if I talk slower, that joke got an extra laugh here and here. All right, and then you go back to a black crowd. And eventually you figure out how to tell the joke, and then it doesn't matter who's in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So those years with them, I'm sorry for talking so damn long, but...
No, it's all good.
Makes sense, because I never would have thought of that.
Made me yeah. more balanced.
Mm-hmm.
Performing for multiple crowds made me more balanced, mm-hmm. and... I had that to a degree when I first started because if you're doing comedy in the South, you can't just, if you're trying to work every week, you can't yeah. just perform for one audience.
Yeah.
I mean, you can if you just do black or just do white, but you're only going to be in one little 3-hour radius banging out the same rooms with the same. So the only way to grow for me back then, it's not like New York or L.A. where you can get 10 different cultures in a week and bounce all over town and get all these different styles. You got to go Birmingham. Then you got to drive 4 hours to Little Rock. Then you got to drive 6 hours back across to Cincinnati. Then you got to go down to Jackson, Mississippi, and then cut across to St. Pete Beach. So that's how you become diverse, is driving more and doing more rooms. But, you know, it was ultimately that time with the Blue Collar Boys that really, by then, I'd perfected that ability.
You knew,
to how to just tell the joke.
Yeah.
And not worry about what the demographic was of the crowd. And all
Yeah, see, I got similar to that. I mean, not on that level. But, yeah, I ended up in a situation like that once before. Because last summer, I worked, they did a special night at Katsuya in Glendale, which is right outside of Los Angeles. And I walk in. I knew the manager. She called me for the gig. I said, okay, cool, let's do it. How long I got? Let's go. I go in, there's no one there. The place is empty.
Mm-hmm. And you up
they got
first.
Us in the back. I was second. They got us in the back. Great sushi. They brought us about $300 worth of sushi.
Yeah.
Laid it out on the table. We're just eating, having fun. All the other comics come in. I'm the only black guy. So I'm like, okay, cool. That'll work. And the first act goes out, and it's this older white lady. I cannot remember her name, but I looked out, and she was a wild act. Like, she was standing on the couch. No. Like, she went from the stage out into the front row, and I was just like, oh, she's everywhere.
Was she kind of an angry, ornery kind of berating the crowd a little
she
bit?
She wasn't really berating the crowd. Okay. She was talking about the sexual act she would do with the guy in the front row, and she was
I think I know who you're talking about. I'm not going to say her name, but I know who you're talking about.
And so I'm like, okay, I see what I'm following. I look out in the crowd. It's a completely Armenian crowd. Sold out.
Well, Glendale.
35, 40 tables. I completely forgot where I was working at. So I told her, Kabik, I'm doing every Armenian joke I got. And if I get stabbed, it's going to be a good night.
So how to end.
And I went out there. I did good. I did good. Yeah, because when I broke into all my Armenian stuff, I didn't talk about anything white, anything black. I went straight for them.
Yeah, initially. You connect with them. And what you could have done, you could have given them one or two to connect with them. And then it gives them this sense of approval. Then they let down their guard.
And then they come down. And you can go any direction. Stuff. And that's exactly
go any direction
what
you want.
That's exactly it, what happened. I think I ended that set talking about Trayvon Martin.
Did you?
And all Armenian crowd.
But Armenians and black people are like kind of the same.
Don't say that to Armenians.
Don't do that.
But I mean, we are.
Armenians. She said that, Mr. Armenian.
We like gold. They like gold. They like flamboyant stuff. So, I mean.
You're right. There's some cultural similarities, but they pride themselves
of
not being black.
Yeah, of course.
We're Armenian. We're not Persian. We're not Arab, we're not white, we're not Mexican, I am Armenian.
I told one guy, I think I said if he had a 7-series Beamer and he went to sleep, he woke up the next morning and had a 3-series, he'd kill himself. And
exactly.
Yeah, it's
and
true.
He laughed.
Yeah,
that's
hilarious.
Yeah, but a black man would do that too.
I don't know, a black dude would just be like, yeah, man, I'm still shining on him, though. I'm still stunning on the bro.
Man.
But that's what comedy is, man. It's just... You're a sociologist to a degree, and you're figuring out what's the thread that connects me with them. And you have a conversation about those things. And to me, comedy has never been anything more complicated than a conversation. Like, you know, I'll talk to young guys, and you know, new comics will hit me up on YouTube or whatever, Twitter. You watch my set. I just started 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago.
I'm like, you're overthinking it. It's just, you just talk to the, share what's funny to you.
Yeah.
And put that up on the stage. And, you know, where the difficulty comes in comedy, and this is where I think a lot of comics lose, is marketing. Mm-hmm. I think they forget to really take that seriously. It didn't matter. There was years that it didn't matter. But social media has put that at the forefront. I've seen guys lose opportunities because they didn't have a good digital presence, I think was the word that was used on me in a meeting, where you have to have, like, I know guys that still don't have social media accounts at all. We're not even getting into counting followers.
Yeah.
That's just not my thing. That's not what hey, that's cool. And it may work for you eventually, but it's probably a later than sooner business plan.
There's no way it can work.
That's insane.
That's
what some of these guys are into, man. And you've got to figure out ways to, I don't want to say lie, but figure out ways to trick yourself, to trick people into giving you opportunities, and mm-hmm. then you deliver. Mm-hmm. And social media gives you ways of doing that. There's people that get videos that are really good that don't do a bunch of hits. They get opportunities. You get networks rolling out checks. Well, I don't want to shoot a video. It's too hard. You can't do that, man. You have to figure out ways to...
To do it for the vine.
Yeah. To do it for the vine. Exactly. Do it.
And they steadily saying, I ain't going to do it.
Yeah. I don't have a problem lying to people if it's true.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I got the radio job.
Yeah, I was just about to go into 95.7 Birmingham, Alabama. Now, 95.7 is important radio station in Birmingham.
I think
Alabama.
The station, I'll say this about that station, I don't think that they get the creative due that they deserve in the hip-hop community for mm-hmm. what they contribute culturally to music in the southern region.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I know they won't get that credit because, you know, some artists have a lot of beef with this. Artists have beef with every station, but,
right.
Oh, you didn't play my song or this song or that song, so screw that station. But creatively, half of the ideas right now, like I got fired from 95.7. Mm-hmm. I got fired when I got cast on Sullivan and Son. It pretty much created an issue of tension of just basically, well, you can't be out there doing work and work.
Mm-hmm.
I have beef with why I was terminated, but creatively, for the 2 years that I was on that station, they let me do things that a black morning show had never done before creatively. And those ideas are still ideas that I'm mining now for television and for the web. I was in a market where I beat Tom Joyner, I beat Ricky Smiley, I beat Steve Harvey. And I'm not saying that to brag. That's just a statistical fact mm-hmm. of how hard that station works mm-hmm. at building up new talent. Ricky is a child of that station. There's four other white DJs that are syndicated nationally that are products of the Birmingham radio region. It's a mm-hmm. very rich talent region, man. And to have been a part of it was a blessing, man. Like, mm-hmm. that was, I lied to get that, but it was still a blessing.
Yeah, What'd you say?
Yeah, that's how what we want to know. How did this happen?
What did you say?
So they were looking for a comedian to be on the morning show when Ricky Smiley left.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was trying to get in at the comedy club and work as an MC. I'd done one or two open mics. I was mm-hmm. sick of it. I wanted to MC the big stage. It was a big stage. The open mic was in a side room. And comedy club in Birmingham, you want to be on the main showroom.
Mm-hmm.
So D.L. Hughley's coming to town that weekend. And I knew that the radio station, the black station always promotes the black comics.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the comedy club owner. I go, look, you know I'm interning over at 95.7. And they said they wanted me to host for D.L. Hughley because I know the jocks come in and they're going to come on stage and throw out T-shirts or whatever. So they're going to do that, and then they're going to bring me up. And then
so
we just run.
It.
So the club owner had to, I don't need to show an ID. The club owner goes, all right, cool. You want to, okay, when
go
did you start?
It. Yeah.
You started over there? Well, congrats. Way to go, Roy. I go, all right, cool. So I leave the comedy club. I drive up the street to the radio station.
Uh-huh.
I go, listen, I know y'all auditioning new comedians and whatnot. And
so you played
you
both
know,
of them.
I know that, you know, you all are looking for guys. And, you know, I don't want to come in here and do my thing. Because I knew if I went in an audition, I was going to tank and they were going to have me. I said, they need to see me on stage first and at least know that I'm capable of being funny. I'm not going to do an in-studio audition. It's a train wreck. Guys were auditioning, and they were bombing on the air. And Birmingham is a brutal-ass city. They will call you. It's worse than New York. I will put the haters in my hometown up against any hater in any city.
Birmingham makes you or breaks you. And
period.
They let you know.
So I wasn't finna get on the radio and get bashed. So I said, listen, I'm going to be at the comedy. You know I'm opening for D.L. Hughley.
Mm-hmm.
They go, really? Well, you must be. All right. Well, we'll see you Friday night.
Yeah.
So all I had to do Friday night was keep the DJ separated from the club owner so that they never talked about me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was it. And so when the DJs went up, they go, so we're bringing you up. Yeah, I'm opening for DL. So y'all go out and throw your T-shirts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll come up after you introduce me and I'm going to do my jokes.
Introduce
and I went up. I ripped. I come off stage. He goes, you start Monday.
Boom.
Wow.
That was it. That's how I started at 95.7.
Wow. And hey, the show is called Success is the New Black, and damn it. That's how you get success.
How long were you there?
I was from 95.7 from 2001 until 2012.
Yeah.
So I was there in a long time. And I still do some stuff in Atlanta now with KISS 104, which is still part of the Cox Media Group family. I love radio. And there's days where it's stressful, it's time-consuming, and it's not the most advantageous expenditure of my time. Mm-hmm. But in the bigger scope of things, of reaching people and connecting with people on a daily basis, you can't beat it, man. You really can't. And I know sooner or later, radio is going to fit into some other bigger piece of a pie. So I want to keep one foot in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I wish things had worked out in Birmingham, but, you know, it's money issues, it's scheduling, it's just a lot of things. It's because it's not like it can't be done. I mean, Steve Harvey got 8 damn shows and still wake up every morning and do a radio show. So I know the technology's there.
Yeah.
But it was just an issue of just money. It just is what it is.
Did you always know you wanted to be in, like, in broadcast, even when you were a kid?
Not when I was a kid, probably high school. Like, up until high school, I wanted to be a firefighter.
Oh, okay.
Like, real talk, like, that's what I wanted to. You couldn't
but
tell
were
me.
You funny in school? Were you class clown?
I wasn't a class clown, but I was like the quick chuckler because I got picked on a lot. I didn't, like, people didn't stop picking on me till the 10th grade, which is when I grew into my head because my head had been the same size since the 4th grade. So people clown me, big head, egghead, head of the class, head, mohead, the head detective. Like, they just berated me. So when I finally started fitting in, I didn't want to crack jokes and drop a bad joke and then start getting cracked on. So I kept quiet, stayed under the radar, but at baseball games, that's kind of where my sense of humor started emerging. Like, I think that was probably what I would consider my first bits of stand-up was riding the bench, and it was our job to heckle the opposing players. If you're on the bench, you heckle that dude when he's in the batter's box, you heckle him around the bases, and there was nobody better than me.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Me and Maxwell Hawkins, we eat your
ass
up.
I remember Maxwell.
Dude, we eat your ass up.
Yeah.
As soon as you get in the batter's box, we crack on you to the point where your own fans laughing at your ass, and you strike out. Like, after the game, they don't even want to give you a high five.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good game.
Yeah, we ain't talking to him.
So that's when I kind of figured, oh, I'm kind of funny when I open my mouth out loud in front of people. And that's kind of what planted the seed.
But where it started.
But for broadcast, it was Stuart Scott. Like, I can literally trace it all the way back to one man. When I used to watch ESPN, Stuart Scott was the first black person. He wasn't the first black person on ESPN, but he talked hip-hop. And he was of our generation And he cracked jokes. And I was like, he's black. They let you crack jokes? Because up until that point, I thought journalism was very, you were listening, and the score and the team won, and the quarterback said, but Stuart Scott was just chilling with it.
He was
chilling. I was like, well, hell, I do that every day at the lunch table.
Yeah.
What do I need to major
in? Where do I sign up?
Broadcast? Okay, cool. Well, that's what I'll do.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. And I took a voice and diction class while I was in college, and voice and diction and impromptu speaking. And so the impromptu speaking, every week you had to make up a speech. Mm-hmm. Every week I came in with the speech, and the teacher would give us the topic, and I'd give my speech, and it always got a laugh. Mm-hmm. To the point where the teacher would flunk me sometimes on the grounds that you need to quit being funny and try to be serious. And I wasn't trying to make the class laugh. It's just you gave me a topic. Yeah, you just gave me this topic, and I'm flowing on it. I can't help these people to laugh. And so that was kind of where, if I look back and I can see footprints of stand-up slowly showing up in my life, it was probably in those areas.
Cool. Who were your inspirations back then, comedically?
Carlin, Chris Rock, Martin Lawrence, too, when I started out. When I started out, I listened to a lot of Martin Lawrence. My dad had old Red Fox vinyls, and I listened to those. And I listened to Pryor and stuff like that, but as far as guys that were, like, doing it and current and, like, right then, like, I think when I was in college was when Chris Rock Bring the Pain came out.
Yeah.
And, oh, right after the Million Man March. Oh, dude.
That was a beast.
Demolished. He demolished. Yeah. And, you know, I watched a lot of guys, but then I went through a stretch in my career where I just didn't watch anybody's stand-up. I watched Comic View. Like, I would watch, when I first started, I would watch Comic View every night to make a list of the topics that other comics were talking about, just so I could avoid those subjects.
Stay away.
Yeah. And it wasn't, it's not a disrespect to any comics that chose those topics. It's just for me, I figured out real fast that if I'm just talking about something different from you, mm-hmm. it's going to get me an opportunity and you'll be called original. You'll be called fresh. Mm-hmm. And, oh, he's clever and witty. And it's, and maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But for me, I understood real fast that different gets you visible, gets you visibility faster mm-hmm. than being similar to anyone else, right down to the topic selection. So yeah. that's the, those were the only comics I watched for a while, because when you watch the people that you really respect and really look up to, if you only watch them over and over and over and over again, you start picking up. Like, my first 2 years of comedy is a horrible Martin Lawrence impersonation. That's really mm-hmm. what it boils down to. It's Martin Lawrence doing jokes about book buyback mm-hmm. and working out in the campus gym because we got rusty weights, and as mm-hmm. soon as you leave the campus gym, you got to go to the campus doctor because you got tetanus, and mm-hmm. it's stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, like now, nowadays, I love to watch Bill Burr. I just bought tickets to see a guy, Doug Stanhope.
Who, I love Doug.
You know, a lot of guys don't know about him, but you know. He's a yeah. beast, man.
Doug is one of my top 10 right now. Doug,
that dude,
beast.
That dude. Like I pay money to go see him.
Yeah, and this, you know, is Chappelle. This is what you do.
Yeah, I pay yeah. money. I sit in a chair. I buy my 2-drink minimum, mm-hmm. and I kick back and enjoy, you know, a great performance. You know, I like a lot of what Tony Rock is doing now. Mm. You know, he just did a set on Arsenio that I think really set him apart from the pack in terms of just perspective and opinion and comedy that I gravitate towards, right. You know, like that type of stuff.
Do you tend to skew more highbrow? Because that's always been my guess about, like, every time I've watched you on stage, the things that you pick out, the things that you like to talk about, like all the way back to your policeman bit. When you did that bit on a Comic View, I don't know if you had a chance to see it, but mm-hmm. he's got a close on a Comic View where he literally acts out an entire traffic stop.
And, but the analysis of it is just, you know, you're going to jail because it takes dispatch longer to come back through the radio.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's just a joke about analysis. And yeah. I mean, and I don't try to be highbrow. I'm just trying to explain things that I see.
The little nuances.
And And once you quit thinking about it in a black or white sense, it's just, mm-hmm. whoever liked me, come see me, man. I don't care no more. You know, all of this, well, I got to get black folks and got to make sure black people like me. Mm-hmm. I think black people respect my comedy. I think black crowds are cool with me, but I know I'm never going to be the guy in an all-black, straight-up Negro night room. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be the guy that just... That's not my style. That's not what I do, and that's not what most of those audiences want on a regular basis. But I think there's more than enough opportunities for performers of any style to get exposure and get opportunities and find their audience. Because at the end of the day, as a comedian, that's all it's about. This whole damn L.A., black Hollywood, all this whole dance is about me being in L.A. long enough to find enough people in this country that'll pay me money to come see me ramble drunk for an hour until I die. That's it. As a comedian, that's it. Now, you can graduate and become an actor. You can pull a Jamie Foxx and, you know, fall back from stand-up a little bit and dominate over here. Or you can go dominate in music. But for me, when I look at stand-up, it's the only genre of entertainment in Los Angeles. Or it's the only genre of entertainment, period, where it don't matter if I get fat. It don't matter if I get on drugs. Mm-hmm. It don't matter if I get old. All the ageism that exists in this city. And, oh, it's hard for black actors to find roles. That's cool. I'm going to St. Louis to tell these jokes and feed my family. And God willing, I'm popular enough and doing well enough to where I don't have to do it 20 days a month. You do it 10 to 12 days and you have enough time to come back home and have a life and have something away from that. But, you know, you look at guys like, look at Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
Bill Cosby got all the money in the world. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for him to ever go back out, but he loves it. Mm-hmm. And Bill Cosby ain't getting cast in the next Star Wars movie. Mm-hmm. No one's checking for send Bill Cosby the script. See if we can make a movie with Bill. Bill Cosby could care less, because even at that age, he can still go out there and do comedy. All he did was add a chair for him to sit in because he's tired of standing up.
Yeah, tired of standing.
That's it.
Well, we're running a little short on time, but I have to get into your quick transition to acting when you moved over into Sullivan and Son. Do you prefer that side of Hollywood to what you had to do to make it in stand-up, or
Ooh, that's a good question. It's a different grind, acting. You know, it's comedic acting, and, you know, I've been blessed enough to be part of a great cast. You know, Steve Byrne, who, you know, starred the show, and Vince Vaughn and Peter Billingsley, executive producing, along with Rob Long. These guys were kind enough to take a chance on me. But Chris Rock said something I found that was very profound. It was years ago on Rolling Stone. He said, everything I do outside of comedy is to bring more people to my comedy. So that's how I look at it. Do I one day want to have my own show? Do I one day want to have my own opportunities and do all of this other stuff in front of a camera? Hell yeah. But at its core, it's so that you'll come see me on the road. And the acting is definitely, you know, comedic acting in a multi-camera comedy. There's some element of stand-up to it because thankfully we perform in front of a live audience. It's not like a single camera where it's just you and the actors and the cameraman. And that live audience feel, it's electric. Those laughs you hear, those are real laughs. So it's not laugh track. So, I mean, we're sitting there and you're having to react in the moment and you'll feel the crowd anticipating something that you didn't even think about doing. And you'll do it right then. And it's electric. And that's awesome. So do I want to do more of that? Hell yeah. But is it difficult to get the auditions and to get cast in that stuff?
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's very competitive. And I feel blessed to still have a way of going out and making money in the meantime or being funny enough, long enough, to where eventually you get to create something for yourself. Steve Byrne wrote that show for himself. If anything, that's an effing blueprint on what I need to be doing for me.
Yeah.
TBS didn't go to Steve Byrne and go, hey, half Asian and white dude, would you like it? We have a show. No, they didn't have no idea.
Yeah.
Steve Byrne sat in the corner with Vince Vaughn and scribbled that damn script out and took it to them. And they went, yeah, that's funny.
We like
we'll
it.
Make it.
Okay.
So that's the same damn thing I'm going to try to do for myself. And I'll marry that thing. Are we in production on Sullivan and Son for 3 months? We go on a national tour for another 3 months? That means I got 6 months over here to put something else together if I want to, man.
But perfect.
We're excited, man. Season 3, we premiere Tuesday, June 24th.
Okay.
We'll be watching.
TBS, man.
That's exciting. Cool. Oh, wait, I want to talk about your prank calls really quick.
Oh, yes.
Please.
Real quick, Steve and Booth, how much time we got? Let us know real quick. All right, we're good. Go ahead.
Black Booty Walrus.
Black Booty Walrus.
Where in the world
did you
black
get booty black walrus?
Booty walrus?
Here's the thing about that. Okay. So what she's talking about is on my pranks, if you listen to them on YouTube, my little cousins from Mississippi do the introductions to each prank. This girl, go to RobertG.com.
I always wonder who that was.
Black booty walrus? You better stop stealing my... Because I went through a stretch where radio DJs were stealing my pranks off of YouTube and playing them and presenting them as their own content. So I had my little cousins just kind of lob a little... Just a little shot at them haters. I didn't tell him to say that. Like Black Booty Walrus,
they
that was a complete moment of improv for my little cousin.
It takes little kids to come up.
9 years old.
Like that
is you fat tooth Billy goat. You buck tooth Billy goat. Now that one I gave him. Okay. I told him to say that one. But yeah, Black Booty Walrus. Yeah,
that was all of him.
That's one of my personal favorites.
That is perfect.
Oh, that's one of the greatest insults.
It's hilarious.
Oh, it's one of the greatest insults of all time.
I would be mad if someone called me a Black Booty Walrus.
Yeah, exactly. It's like an insult that you didn't even know was an insult until you hear it.
And then you think about it, and then you think about what a walrus looks like. You're like, I look like a Black Booty.
The hell you mean, black booty walrus?
But yeah, the pranks are fun, man. You know, it's the one thing that still connects me with a lot of people online because, you know, they've spread. They went viral years ago.
Yeah.
What was your favorite one?
My favorite is Wallet on a Slave Ship, where I called a cruise ship company. And I
almost
them,
listened to that one, but I had so many to pick.
Oh, there's hundreds.
I had to stop myself from watching them because my dog was looking at me like, you're crazy. I would have tears strolling down. I'm trying to eat Skittles, so there's like rainbow
just everywhere.
Like, spit everywhere. I'm like, I can't do this anymore.
I called a cruise ship company. I told him my granddaddy left his wallet on the slave ship when he came from Africa.
Oh, no.
And I want them to check lost and found. And the lady tried to help me find the ship.
No.
Yeah. That's my favorite one. The one that's the most popular, though, is Barber's Check. That's the one I called the old black lady and told her we were going to cut her check to help Hurricane Katrina victims.
Mm-mm.
And she's like, you ain't gonna cut my social security check.
Yeah.
She went ballistic on me.
And so on and so forth.
My favorite was when the tooth with the kid.
Oh, Omar's tooth?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also telling the lady, That she needs to sit in the back of the pew at church.
Oh, because her breath's so bad.
Her breath smelled so
Nobody
bad.
Nobody wanted to share
no
him.
No one, because
she's
smoking. I was like, no.
You know what's funny about those prank calls, though, man? Like, I'm at a point now where I want to do one more album at some point this year.
That's what I wanted to ask you.
I really do. I enjoy prank phone calls. Mm-hmm. But I listen at the stuff that I said. Like, some of those pranks are 8 to 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I don't know if I would have the guts now.
They're
to say
still
that.
So funny, though.
It's edgy as hell, though.
It's super edgy. I'm like, no, this is, don't say that.
You gotta remember.
Yeah. Like, I'm scared to hear what they're gonna say after you say
it. You gotta remember, I put those pranks out before the Thought Police started trolling the internet to try to tear down people because they said one naughty word to somebody. Yeah. And I got away with a lot of stuff because them pranks was pre-Twitter, man.
Yeah.
But I want to do one more. I just got to get the courage up to real. Because if I can't do it at that level,
I want you to call my grandma.
Then I'm like outcast at Coachella.
Yeah,
and I'm just out there
you're right.
Looking like ass.
Anybody awake? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to have an outcast at Coachella prank album.
Yeah.
I want this to be something good.
We can try. That'll be a good test call. Let him call your grandma.
Yeah,
and
please
see what happens.
Call Mike. She will give you the like. Oh my gosh.
You serious?
I promise.
I'll
because
call
she's
her.
Crazy,
he'll do it.
And she entertains like bill collectors.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So like she would
He's
sit there
do it
for
now.
She would give you 30 minutes of a good show.
All right, let's rack it up. We'll do that.
We have to do that.
I'm gonna do that because what I'm gonna do with the new ones, Beyonce inspired me. I'm gonna do a visual prank album. Not sexual. I'm going to animate the pranks.
Okay.
So it's going to be a full animated album as well. But
are you going to do one with a shower curtain rod?
I probably should now.
Yeah. You have to now, especially after last week.
Mimi, her ass.
All right. Well, man, I want to keep going, but I don't know. The white people may tell me to stop.
Yeah,
they're telling me to stop.
Go to music.
Yeah.
I'll take your mug.
Black Booty Walrus.
RoyWoodJr.com,
suckers.
Yo, that's your website. Where can they find you at on Twitter, right?
Everything's Roy Wood Jr.
Everything.
So wherever you are, Roy Wood Jr. That's it.
That's
Vine,
it.
Instagram, Twitter, whatever the hell, .com, and Facebook, whatever.
Instagram.
There you go. So English?
You can find me on Instagram at Pink English as well as on Twitter, English Speak.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. We're the two hosts here that have different...
Facebook.
We're the only people that have different like titles on our Twitter and our Instagram. Like we do that.
Somebody stole
your name. Yeah, you can always find me on Twitter at Rome the Ruler, just like Rick the Ruler. That's where I stole it from. So, I want to thank Mr. Roy Wood.
This was
Jr.
fun, man. I appreciate how you guys conduct an interview as well.
This was fun
to do. It wasn't some miserable hell.
Oh yeah,
that
nah,
some. Radio shows can be.
We try to make it fun, man. I appreciate
name
you
names,
coming.
But
oh yeah, yeah. You can name a few.
No,
all right.
I want to know the name of that white comedian too when we get off the air.
Okay, cool. We'll
that
do that.
Lady
all right.
Was,
yeah,
I think I know.
Yeah. Well, for Roy Wood Jr., for Miss English Cleveland, for myself, Rome Moore. This has been Success is the New Black. Black Hollywood Live, Birmingham. Stand up.
From producers Maria Menounos, Dario Kristen, Tiana Hobson, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire BHL crew, we would like to thank you for supporting Black Hollywood Live, the first online broadcast network dedicated to African-American entertainment. For questions and comments, contact us at info@blackhollywoodlive.com. Like us on Facebook, tweet us, or Instagram us at BHL Online. And I'm your BHL announcer, Scipio. Instagram me at Planet Scipio. Thank you for tuning in.
Hollywood redefined.
The views expressed here are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of BHL or its owners or principals.